To get in. Kurt, thank you very much. Your work sets a standard for many, and we've all learned from your catalogs and learned today as well. I'm happy to introduce another new attendee. Did you come to to Santa Barbara?
Yeah.
And then Brian tried to get on the program then, and we were full up, so I'm very happy to have Brian and here to talk about the Pacifica Radio Sound Archive, I guess this country's oldest group of independent stations. Brian has recently become the archivist there. I say relatively recently. I won't talk about what you used. Well, I will talk about what he used to do. First time I ever talked to Brian, I think that I learned that the Pacific Archive had moved from Venice, California, to North Hollywood. And I told him that I'd spent some time in North Hollywood in the Bob Hope Archives. And Brian said, oh, I've been there. And I said, gosh, Bob Hope and Pacifica. That is not a combination that I ever really considered. And I said, really? You know, as part of Pacific? He says, no, when I work for Zsa Zsa Gabor. So that's probably the first time the name Zsa Zsa Gabor has come up at an ARS meeting for 35 years. And I'm happy to be the one to utter it. Please welcome Brian. Thanks for coming.
Great. Does everybody want to stand up and stretch for a second? Feeling all right? Glass of water, restroom, whatever. It's cool. While we find what we're going for. Also, I want to say that, you know, this is the first time that we've made a presentation to an organization like this, other than our own organization. So it's not going to be deep in the minutiae that you're used to. So because of what Pacifica is, I'll sort of open up the dialogue. And so feel free to jump in, ask questions, challenge me. Not too harshly, and then we'll go from there. But basically what we want to do is give you an overview of what Pacifica is, where it began, and the landmarks that it has created throughout its history. We'll be concentrating mostly on the first 30 years. It began in 1949. We'll be going through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is where the bulk of the collection is. And good news, we have a lot of sound clips, so we'll be sharing a lot of good stuff with you. There we are. The oldest collection of public radio programming in the United States. The reason for that is it's the first publicly funded radio station in the United States. Began in 1949, and we'll go from there. That's me. There are five stations currently in the Pacifica network, KPFA in Berkeley, which was the flagship station, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFK in Los Angeles, which is where the archive is located, WBAI in New York, and KPFT in Houston, Texas. And this is the founder, Lewis Hill. The Pacifica Radio Archives did create a mission statement in 1971 when it was originally established. Before then, each of the stations had collected or just saved the records or the reel-to-reel tape. The first 10 years, 1949 to 1959, are relatively disappeared because of the funding and because of the way that it was set up. They went on the air, asked for money from the public. They didn't have enough money to keep stock of reel-to-reel, so most of the stock was either recycled or just thrown away. So the mission statement supports the mission goals of the Pacifica Radio, which is about free speech, and we'll get more into the mission of Pacifica itself later. And in doing so, we'll appraise, collect, organize, describe, preserve, and make available for research and reference use the past, present, and future creative work of generated by or produced in association with Pacifica Radio. In particular, the PRA will focus its attention on those materials which reflect the memory, traditions, and evolution of the Pacifica Foundation. PRA assesses and serves the programming, production, and research needs of Pacifica Radio and its extended community. This includes Pacifica personnel, Pacifica listeners, the media community, and the research community at large. All right, let's see what's next. Can you go ahead and start the first CD? We'll go ahead and start with a big fat 7-minute clip.
The following program was produced by Andrea Kissick and Susan Stone on the occasion of the 50th birthday of KPFA-FM, April 15th, 1999.
Radio.
talking.
Radio.
Two sides are still talking.
Broadcasting actually started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on April 15, 1949. On the other hand, according to the improvised schedule of those days, the station went off the air at 6 o'clock so that the staff, all seven of us, could go to supper.
And then on a spring afternoon 50 years ago, a small team of pacifists marched to the top floor of an office building on University Avenue in Berkeley. There, they made history. In a few weeks, these women and men had built a tiny broadcasting studio. Then, at 3 p.m., someone gave the signal to their leader. A charismatic, chain-smoking, ex-conscientious objector named Lewis Hill sat before a microphone. "This is KPFA-FM in Berkeley," Hill told whoever he prayed could pick up the signal from a 550-watt government surplus transmitter. It was April 15th, 1949. The first listener-sponsored radio station in the United States was born. Since that moment, KPFA has offered its listeners access to diverse thoughts, values, and voices. Its mission? To reflect in its radio programming social and economic justice, informed local and global perspectives, news, arts, and music. These airwaves have broadcast hundreds of civic and political leaders, writers, composers, poets, folk singers, musicians, artists, thinkers with no public role, and concerned citizens. KPFA was, and is today, a voice for the voiceless. But it is not just a story of an extraordinary radio history. It is your story, telling about your freedom to challenge and advocate for change, telling about your lives for half a century.
The arrested man will be booked but released on his own recognizance, and the university, which is the complainant, will not press charges.
I've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being.
Do the Constitution of the United States mean anything? So far, it hadn't worked, and I'm sick of seeing this kind of stuff on paper. We want them to do something about it because we are a part of America. Because we didn't come here on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings.
The duration, this is for, the duration of the suspension of the suspended students
on a gas
will be submitted within 1 week
fellow warriors
to the
for freedom.
Student Conduct Committee of the Academic
I'm
Senate.
I'm happy
to the administration.
To welcome you here. This conference, the fourth annual spring conference of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and to welcome you to the city of Atlanta.
Five.
A city with a good image. A city that is too busy to hate. The little New York, the gateway to the South.
Okay, so that gives you sort of a little bit of a taste of where we come from, what kind of materials that we have in the archive, which is where we're going next, to sort of give you another big taste of how broad and extensive the collection is. The collection is 47,000 or more reel-to-reel recordings, and is just a drop in the bucket when it comes to what really should be there. The subjects that we cover, basically the big chunk, the most significant historically material, is the civil rights movement. And that is because what Pacifica was, they went out and recorded people like Fannie Lou Hamer, Paul Robeson, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, James Baldwin, when nobody else was recording them. The Malcolm X collection is probably the most significant, particularly to the Malcolm X scholars, Manning Marable, Henry Louis Gates Jr. and such. The scholars are really impressed with it because nobody else was recording Malcolm X at that early stage. If you think about the major media at that time, being what most people would consider racist at the time, they were not concerned with these speakers. Even Martin Luther King Jr., we have rare recordings of Martin Luther King Jr., a press conference in 1967, I believe it was, when he went and visited Joan Baez in prison in Santa Rita. And actually, when I found that, I contacted Joan Baez, and she didn't know that he had given a press conference after he had visited her in jail. So we took that speech onto the air on Pacifica and had Joan Baez come in and listen to it and respond. And that's one of the ways that we work in the archives to expose and make accessible the recordings and sort of define how important they really are. There he is, Dr. King. Also, we found a speech by Dr. King in the archive that the Martin Luther King Center did not know about. And it was a speech in Los Angeles in a church, don't remember the date right now, but it was about the philosophy of nonviolent protest. It wasn't his speech in motivating the audience or motivating a group of people, but it was his definition of how he came to be who he was and the philosophy of Mahatma Gandhi and the pacifists that he had been inspired by. And also, when we look at ethnic studies, we find that because Pacifica allowed so many different types of speakers and voices to come on the air, we have different course studies that academia is interested in. Let's see where we can go with this. Yeah, McCarthyism. That's pretty relevant right now. A lot of the stations, as we serve our stations, request a lot of recordings about the House Un-American Activities Commission and everything McCarthyism. We have Bertolt Brecht's testimony in front of HUAC, Paul Robeson's testimony in front of HUAC, and a Pacifica programmer, William Mandel, who was a Sovietologist, had a program about communism on the air for decades. He just published his autobiography called Saying No to Power. And that's important. We'll actually play a clip of William Mandel's testimony in a few minutes. Middle East studies, that's pretty important. There's a program called Middle East in Focus that's been on the station in Los Angeles for more than 20, 25 years. So that program really had a lot of focus when the problems erupted in the Middle East. So here we go with the 1950s, and these are the landmark things that happened that, because Pacifica allowed free speech, things usually went to the courts. Some things went to the Supreme Court. So we have opponents to the Korean War are among the many minorities' viewpoints given freedom of speech on Pacifica during the McCarthy era. Alan Watts was a philosopher of Eastern philosophy and was basically the man responsible for bringing Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, to America and to the public. And his programs are still being aired on Pacifica Radio. It's the I Love Lucy of Pacifica. It's been running since the 50s, and KPFK in Los Angeles, they're played in the middle of the night, like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and believe it or not, we do make copies available to listeners, and it's still something that really does sell. People still call and request copies of the Alan Watts materials. Somewhere around 53 hours are in the archive of Alan Watts. And of course, one of my favorite ones is the marijuana case. And that's when, you know, some programmers went into the studio, had, you know, one of the water pipes and everything, and were explaining how to do it, so that, of course, they were arrested and impounded.
The legendary African-American historian, sociologist, and educator, W.E.B. Du Bois, co-founded the NAACP and founded its Crisis magazine. In a rare recording of a speech given in Southern California on February 20th, 1953, Dr. Du Bois speaks of the meaning of socialism and the challenge to Americans to provide meaningful work to all.
The object of work is life, not income. The reward of production is plenty, not private property. We should measure the prosperity of a nation not by the number of millionaires, but by the absence of poverty, the prevalence of health, the efficiency of the public schools, and the number of people who can do read worthwhile books.
W.E.B. Du Bois is really important. In fact, just last month was the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Souls of Black Folk. And Pacifica Radio came to the archives to give us the job of doing a radio documentary or a special on it. So what we did, we had all this recordings of Du Bois, which when I contacted the scholars of Du Bois, Henry Louis Gates Jr., Gerald Horn, Playthell Benjamin, they weren't aware of these recordings. So that's how, when we talk about the Pacific Archives, not very many people know about it, particularly scholars. You think Manning Marable, Malcolm X, he didn't really know how extensive our collection was until I contacted him about working with us. And same thing with the Du Bois scholars. So what we did was we had the archival clips played, had the scholars come on, listen, and respond, as well as people like Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Diane Watson, to also lend their ideas about who Du Bois was when they first read the book and how they were influenced by him. So that, and actually we have a clip of that, maybe if we have some time, which we might not, we might play a little bit of that. Here's another clip. Nope, that's not a clip. Here's some more stuff. 1955, poet Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlin Getty bring the Beat Generation to the airwaves. A few years later, FCC questions Pacifica's broadcast of some of their works as vulgar, obscene, and in bad taste, particularly Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl, which was aired originally on Pacifica Radio and went to the FCC and I believe the Supreme Court. I get confused on some of the court cases, so pardon me if I speak incorrectly. 1956, Pacifica wins its first broadcast awards for a program on the First Amendment. 1957, wins another Peabody Award on their programming on McCarthyism. I think this is maybe a clip coming next. Yeah.
In 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, it was illegal for a black person to be seated on a bus if a white person had to stand. Rosa Parks was a black woman, a seamstress who was riding such a bus home from work when the bus driver ordered her to give up her seat to a white passenger. Her refusal was directly responsible for the ensuing Montgomery bus boycott. Her act of peaceful resistance helped bring about the nonviolent civil rights movement. She explained what happened in a 1955 interview on KPFA.
The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama.
Rosa Parks, I think what's really important, or at least how I react or connect with this recording emotionally, is that when you think about the quality of the human voice, and as we listen to the spoken word recordings, this is a recording that when you listen to it, her voice is very youthful, almost innocent. I think as most people know who Rosa Parks is now, sort of the icon of the civil rights movement and lauded for her courage, we tend to forget that there was a time when she wasn't influenced by her power and her notoriety and her celebrity. So this recording in 1955 was before the notoriety, when she did have, it was the first time or maybe the second time she'd been asked these questions. So that's another reason why these recordings are so significant. In 1958, the nuclear war and the arms race are debated on the air by Nobel Prize winner Linus Pauling and Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb. Again, recently, with the war, the stations requested this broadcast to be rebroadcast. So we did pull it out, and it really is an incredible debate. The archives is working with Dr. Helen Caldicott right now, the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and was a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979 for her work in that organization. And so she actually listened to this recording, and then we did a new program with her.
Paul Robeson is one of the best known artists to have been effectively banned from performing as a result of anti-communist hysteria in the 1950s. A singer and actor, his portrayal of Othello in 1943 was the longest running Broadway Shakespearean play. In a 1958 interview on KPFA, Robeson was asked if his art had suffered or profited because of his political views and actions.
I feel that they've profited. They've only suffered when they've suffered by the fact that because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art.
Again, Paul Robeson, a person that is well known to most of the public because of his movies, his film, his singing, Old Man River, all that, but he's really little known about his political life and his trips to Russia or the Soviet Union at the time. So again, this recording is important because it was 1958 when nobody was asking him these questions. They only wanted to know, are you going to sing? So when he came into the studio, they asked those different questions, which is again why this recording is so significant. We have Paul Robeson talking about his politics and his art and bridging the gap.
Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's the horse for a kid that's black?
I know these are like small little clips, but I just wanted to sort of give you a taste again of the quality of the human voice. When we read Langston Hughes, it's one thing. When we hear Langston Hughes's voice, it's a completely different matter. And I think with television, the media, so much of that is accessible, and we tend to forget that the quality of the human voice of these speakers, writers, literati, intellectuals, is really important because of their inflection, intonation, and hearing him read that poem is really emotional. And I have to say my passion for all of these recordings sometimes comes through. I think Fannie Lou Hamer, I cried once out in public when I heard her. Okay, we get into the 60s. House Un-American Activities Committee. Yeah, there you go. The Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee investigate Pacifica programming for subversion. Broadcasts of writings by Bertolt Brecht, Norman Cousins, Kerry Williams, Dorothy Healy, and W.E.B. Du Bois were cited, as well as William Mandel, who we'll hear from in a second. 1966, the FCC requests a tape of the Pacifica broadcast of Lawrence Ferlinghetti that found it in bad taste, with strong implications against religion, government, the president, law enforcement, and racial groups, and demands full information on Pacifica finances and governance. So this is really the time when the government said, holy, what are they doing? They can't do that. So because the station was founded on the First Amendment principles, they usually got what they wanted.
Hysteria reached a peak in the United States in the 1950s. Congress established the notorious House Committee on Un-American Activities, known as HUAC. The committee interrogated Americans about their alleged communist connections, holding them in contempt if they refused to answer. In 1957, HUAC came to San Francisco and, among others, called William Mandel to testify. Mandel was a Sovietologist, a committed civil libertarian, and was a programmer and commentator on Pacifica station KPFA. Mandel rocked the committee with his testimony.
Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Honorable beaters of children and sadists, uniformed and in plain clothes. Distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman. Eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution. If you think I'll cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
Yeah, that always gets you rocking, doesn't it? Woohoo. I am constantly stunned by that recording. You know, I know Mr. Mandel well. I've had him on the radio interviewing him and as part of some of my broadcasts. And he kind of hates this clip because he feels that most of the public define him by this clip. But I continued to argue with him. I said, no, you don't understand. When people hear this clip, they understand it. They understand the HUAC and the problems and that there were people that didn't buy into it, that just really stepped up to the plate and said, hell no. I think it's also really significant that he was a Pacifica programmer. And this really sort of illustrates what kind of people come to Pacifica, what they do, and their passion for their thing in using Pacifica airwaves to promote or sort of expose their ideas and views. And William Mandel is certainly the penultimate of that. Here we go. Jack Levine, the FBI agent who first exposed J. Edgar Hoover. The program is followed by threats of arrests and bombings, as well as pressure from the FBI, the Justice Department, and major broadcast networks. Because this is, again, a very significant moment when the government and the public really noticed that Pacifica Radio had the courage to say what nobody else was saying. I.F. Stone, Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, one of my favorite recordings, or favorite voices in the archive, leading a long list of luminaries to oppose the war in Vietnam in this early stage of direct U.S. involvement. Bertrand Russell, how many people know who Bertrand Russell is? Okay, that's good. All right, so Bertrand Russell, an 18th century man, born in the, no, what, 19th century man, thank you, 19th century man, living in the 20th century. In the 1950s, he was talking about the problems with nuclear war, but not from the standpoint of a military person or a military mind, but from an intellectual, a mathematician, a philosopher, and the idea that in the 19th century, the humanity did not have a weapon that could destroy humanity in such a large scale. So he was really talking about the H-bomb, the atom bomb, and Hiroshima in a way that said, you know, we now have crossed the point of having the power to kill annihilate ourselves. Vietnam, Chris Koch was the very first American reporter to cover the war from North Vietnam. And of course, those recordings are extremely significant and rare. And Chris Koch is still around. Chris Koch is still around. Another clip.
I appeal to you, citizens of America, as a person concerned with liberty and social justice. Many of you will feel that your country has served these ideals. And indeed, the United States possesses a revolutionary tradition which, in its origins, was true to the struggle for human liberty and for social equality. It is this tradition which has been introduced by the few who rule the United States today.
Yeah. You know, again, the quality of the human voice. This man has that older, gentlemanly, again, 19th century voice, British. Again, once you get into what he's really talking about, his ideas and his philosophies, you really sort of understand the world better than you did before you heard him. Okay, first one isn't that interesting to read out. 1967, Che Guevara. Live interview with Che Guevara, another revolutionary that certainly most people in America didn't know about at the time, 1967. But we do have that recording, and he talks about what the revolutionary stands for, what makes the revolutionary. And it's a pretty incredible recording. I do not have that clip with me today. 1970, KPFT in Houston goes on the air and is bombed twice by the Ku Klux Klan. Attacks were on its transmitter tower after months of inactivity by federal agents and Houston police. That's an important note. The KKK bombed us. The police didn't come. Which recently we had a bomb threat in Los Angeles. I called the police. They didn't come. That's my conspiracy theory, you know. It's all part of Pacifica. Federal agents ultimately arrest a Klansman and charge him with plotting to blow up KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, as well as KPFT, the grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan that was arrested, states that it was his proudest moment. I think this is important. Also, this is a recording that we have of the grand wizard. He actually was interviewed by Pacifica about why he did the bombing, and he said, oh, yeah. So there you go, Pacifica. yeah, we'll ask the questions. That's right, free speech, you know, and yeah, we can talk about that more later. But yeah, the Grand Wizard was, yeah, I bombed your radio station, but sure, I'll grant you an interview. I think it's certainly incredible that the KKK was so threatened by Pacifica. You know, in Texas, at that time in 1970, we were still playing civil rights movement recordings, still, you know, Malcolm X and those things were rebroadcast, and certainly African American studies and civil rights issues were being broadcast. They didn't like it. I think we have a clip of this somewhere. 1974, the SLA delivers the Patty Hearst tapes to KPFA Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. KPFK manager Will Lewis is jailed for refusing to turn over the tapes to the FBI. In the summer of 1974, KPFA staff and programmers go on to strike to demand more democratic decision-making process, the reinstatement of the fired Third World staff, and the firing of station management. After KPFA is off the air for 1 month, Pacifica agrees to most of the strikers' demands. In the fall, KPFA formally creates the Third World Programming Department with a paid department head and control over some airtime. This really sort of talks about the internal politics of Pacifica. There's constantly, from the very beginning, 1949, a constant, perpetual struggle over power, the airwaves, which group gets what hour on which station, for what purpose, and, you know, there's a really good story. Larry Binsky in Berkeley was a manager of KPFA in the 70s, and there were five programs on the grid that were lesbian programs. So he was trying to consolidate them. Okay, yeah, it's fine, but let's have 1 hour for lesbian issues, not 5 hours. All five groups say, yeah, we're not the same as them. We have our idea about this, and they have their idea about that. So it's a constant struggle. George Carlin's famous seven dirty words you can't say on television routine was broadcast on WBAI in New York in 1973 and leads to several years of First Amendment litigation and a hearing by the U.S. Supreme Court. No sanctions are imposed, but the Carlin case sets the limits of broadcasting for over a decade. Now, and you think about cable TV and what's going on with what you see on TV, it's not that big of a deal, right? 1976, a Pacifica documentary on the assassination of Orlando Letier is instrumental in piecing together evidence that later convicts the murderers.
Wednesday, March 28, 1979, 4 a.m. at the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor, something went terribly wrong. And what followed became the country's worst commercial reactor accident in history. Patsy McCormick in Pennsylvania Governor Richard Thornburgh's office issued the first public statement.
There was, early this morning, a malfunction at it's called Three Mile Island nuclear plant, which is 11 miles from Harrisburg. Everything now is under control. There is no danger to public health.
In spite of the reassurance, a pump had broken down and some radioactive steam had escaped from the reactor. Officials at the plant called a general emergency. But Metropolitan Edison, which ran the plant, defended the technology of the plant and of nuclear reactors. Pacifica Station KPFA refused to accept the official story proffered here by a utility spokesperson.
We have absolutely no question about the safety of nuclear plants as a result of this mishap. We do not refer to it as a nuclear accident because it was not that. We think the record of the nuclear industry stands for itself.
How can you say it's not an accident when radiation is being detected as far away as 16 miles?
Well, that doesn't constitute an accident. The accident did not occur in the nuclear reactor. The accident did not occur inside the reactor in the slightest. It was a feed pump connected to the turbine outside of the reactor area. Uh-huh. Now, that was a failure of a piece of machinery, and therefore it was an accident a failure of a piece of machinery. There's no relationship between that and what is thought of as a nuclear accident.
He got caught. He said the word, it was an accident. Another one of my favorite recordings. So that's sort of done with the clips in the PowerPoint presentation. I know we have about 13 minutes. So I sort of want to go through the rest of it really quickly. And then maybe we have some time for Q&A, because I bet you have some questions. So right now, the archives is sort of at its best point ever in terms of staffing, in terms of identity, public outreach. Pacifica Foundation recently, when it was taken back over by the good people as opposed to the bad people, don't ask questions. They basically gave the archive the ability to go and raise its own funds for its preservation. The foundation basically had given us our dole, our percentage of what was raised on the foundation on-air fund drives, but that clearly was not enough to keep us rolling, and particularly not enough to address the major issue, which is most of the recordings that we have in the archive now are at the end of their life. So we have to do something about it. Currently, we're digitizing as much as we can through listener requests, through our own programming, like the Du Bois special that we did. All the Du Bois stuff is digitized. So all those recordings, Malcolm X is all digitized, Fannie Lou Hamer's all digitized. But again, as we know, that's not the answer. That's not the end result, which is what Pacifica people think is what should be happening. So we just received a grant from the Recording Academy to work on a best practices manual. Ooh, I have a slide about that. Wait a minute. Right, so right now, the archives, this is our staff, this is sort of our departments, what we do, and have a lot of staff and a lot of help. Good team. All right, so here's the grant. The National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences just gave us a grant for preservation and access, and it's the first phase of a long project. Pacifica Radio Archives will undertake an expert professional preliminary appraisal and assessment of its collection, resulting in recommendations for best practices and actionable plans for preservation priorities, conservation strategies, and improved access and descriptive documentation. PRA's collection of 47,000 audio tapes constitutes a unique record of social, political, cultural, and artistic history of the past 54 years, as heard on Pacifica's five listener-supported non-commercial stations in California, New York, D.C., and Texas. Does anybody know the difference between Pacifica and NPR? PBS? One. I'm going to tell you. All right, so Pacifica takes absolutely no money from underwriting, foundations, grants, corporations. You won't see the Exxon Oil Hour. So it's absolutely listener sponsor only. We get CPB money, but that's because of some sort of legal thing that we have to take the money. And that's sort of an issue too at the national board. So NPR, PBS grew out of the Pacifica ideal, but then sort of made it a little bit more gray area, where they take monies from different corporations. But as we're all seeing now, NPR is now being controlled by those people, and cultural programming being wiped out. Recently, during the war, they were receiving no submissions from external or independent producers. The only people that produced programming on NPR during the war were staff members that were dictated to by their superiors. So Youth Radio in Berkeley, California, an amazing group of youth that are on NPR, and they're progressive in their politics and in their storytelling, and NPR refused to take their submissions. So this is basically one part of what we do, which is contributing materials to film, television, radio documentaries, museum exhibitions, and educational CD-ROMs. In terms of copyrights and licensing, there is little known about what is owned by Pacifica. And again, copyright, as we heard Linda talk about yesterday, is so detailed and difficult that it would take $1 million just to deal with the copyright issues at Pacifica, but we do the best we can. And because we use the airwaves of Pacifica and the museum exhibitions, it falls under the educational fair use, in my opinion. All right, so Richard Avedon exhibit in Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. This was in June of this past year. Richard Avedon, who photographed all the intellectuals and luminaries of the 60s, they came to us and said, we want to do the audio tour of the museum exhibition. So we had Portrait of Carson McCullers. We had Carson McCullers reading from A Member of the Wedding. It was really quite powerful. Made in California, LA County Museum of Art, PBS American Masters Lillian Hellman, KPFA on the Air, which is a PBS documentary. And people like the National Park Service come to us with some of their programming or programs that they distribute to their employees on inspiring about the national parks. They came to us for historic environmental recordings like Rachel Carson and Al Gore, believe it or not. Programming. W.E.B. Du Bois special commemorating the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Souls of Black Folk. Passion for Survival with Dr. Helen Caldicott, 12-part series featuring Nobel Prize nominee in dialogue narrated by Lily Tomlin. The Du Bois special narrated by Alfre Woodard. Clear and Present Danger is an ongoing series that we partnered with the Penn Center USA, which is the oldest human rights organization in the world, focusing on civil liberties. And Juneteenth celebration focusing on civil rights recordings. It's a special national broadcast. We played James Baldwin, Rosa Parks, Eldridge Cleaver, Malcolm X, and had Congresswoman Maxine Waters comment. So that's sort of the end of the PowerPoint presentation. We have 7 minutes. We can listen to a clip or we can answer questions. Yeah, the requests aren't necessarily in judging what's important to preserve. It's basically somebody wants a copy of something. You know, I see in your on your website and your online catalog, which there is a website, online catalog, that they can look for anything. And if it's available via copyright, then we can make a copy for them. At that point, we go back to the master. If it's in good condition, then we transfer it to digital. And then that's sort of how it happens. So there really is no strategic plan for preserving specific parts of the collection. Some things are sort of obvious, you know, that we have more Anais Nin recordings than anybody else, and to hear her little bird-like voice reading from her erotica is really quite phenomenal. Anybody else? You in the back? No, and again, I think that's mostly because of copyright, that you know, the archivists or whoever was saving the tape, you know, if it was, had music on it, we can't really do anything with it. We won't preserve it. There are some things. William Malik, I believe, had a program, and there is one recording that I'm aware of that I know I digitized and shared with somebody, New York Library, I think it was, and William Malik's interviews with people that worked with Mahler. So it's some of it. Not much, but it's, a lot of the music stuff isn't cataloged. If it's there, it's not cataloged. We would just have to sort of go back in the back and look on the box. Yes, sir.
I worked at the KPFA doing programming from about 1974 to about 1994. We were music programming. We did lots of interviews. I worked a lot with Carl Bernhardt.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm a Carmian. How do you say his last name? Thank you. His name does come up in the catalog, so I would, you know, do a search online to see if anything comes up. You know, more specific keywords about the programming than I do. So perhaps, and it could be in the archive, it's just not cataloged yet. Yes, sir. Leave it up to the requester. Because we don't have the kind of staff that can deal with that that level of copyright research and... Yes. With the archives, we do go out in the field and record. We just recently recorded 6 hours of Angela Davis at a university in Los Angeles. And so we do go with speaker releases currently. It's the back stuff that they're at the radio station level, the programmer level, they don't get releases, or if they do, they don't know what to do with them. You know, there is no process. Nobody told them to send that to the archive with the tape. So sometimes it's there, we have to look hard for it. Sometimes it's just not there, and we just sort of judge by the materials, the intention of the speaker, and you know, it is my sort of call as to judging what the integrity of the original speaker was, what the people want to do with it, and how that sort of justifies some sort of relationship. 3 minutes and counting. Anybody else? Oh, all right. That's it. Oh, I do have something now. One more thing. I did bring a lot of copies of CDs. So I have collected speeches of Fannie Lou Hamer, Malcolm X, a whole bunch of stuff. I don't sell them or anything. Just not enough for everybody, but if somebody wants to look at them and have them, Yeah, do that. Thanks a lot.
And we're going to start it again.